Welcome to Bookwaves on Cover to Cover. I'm Richard Walensky. My guest is Gary Steingart, whose latest novel is Super Sad True Love Story. Earlier novels, The Russian Debutante's Handbook and Absurdistan. Super Sad True Love Story takes place in a dystopian kind of present-day future. As I was reading it, because much of the focus is on this future world, what it struck me as was something which I haven't seen written in any of the reviews about it. This is a science fiction novel.
Yeah. Nobody likes to use those two dirty words, science and fiction, together. It's science fiction only in so much as it is set in the near future. By near future, I'm talking about Tuesday or something like that, you know, maybe a little later than that. But, you know, it's a very probable future for me. I don't have any problems with it. The thing is, I don't know anything about science. So I had a research assistant who taught me what a proton was and a neutron and a protractor and stuff like that.
The reason I mention that is because most science fiction for years is not necessarily science-oriented. Certainly Ursula K. Le Guin's wasn't, and dystopian novels by people like Philip K. Dick or J.G. Ballard were considered science fiction. And now we've got an entire generation of mainstream novels which are science fiction in the sense that these other books were marketed that way, only nobody talks about it.
No, well, you know, when you market for science fiction, it's a much smaller audience that you're marketing for. Literary fiction, which is how I'm sure everyone associated with this book would like it to be known as, literary fiction is much more marketable. And, you know, this is just a simple demographic matter. Women comprise about 70% or more of the readers of serious fiction, and science fiction may not appeal to them, or at least publishers think that it may not appeal to them as much as so-called literary fiction. So, you know, as they say, stress the love part of this story. Super sad true love story.
Right. I was looking through some comments on my website, and someone said, do more science fiction. And then I realized, well, you know, I'm interviewing you. I've interviewed Margaret Atwood. I interviewed Justin Cronin. I mean, these are all science fiction, but they're not marketed that way, so we have to call them mainstream.
Exactly. Yeah, thank you for mainstreaming me.
Gary Steingart, let's talk about the novel, Super Sad True Love Story. First of all, why the name?
I'm really bad with names. I just can't get names right. The story behind this was we tried about 100 different names. And I did want a love in there because I wanted people to understand that it really, in my heart of hearts, this is a story of two people. They're in love. The society around them is a disaster. You know, sort of riffing off 1984, Julia and Winston, they're in love. Big Brother's prying them apart. Here it's a cartoon otter that's in charge of the country. Big Otter is trying to pry them apart. One of the horrible titles I thought of was The Army of Love. And I was asked by the U.S. military to go read to our soldiers who are coming back, you know, not entirely in whole pieces from the wars, the various wars we're waging. And one of the soldiers said, sir, permission to speak freely. The Army of Love is a terrible title. And I said, all right, I'm going to go back to the drawing board on that one.
Eventually, you found a way to sneak in the title into the book anyway.
Yes, exactly.
I understand that when you began this novel in 2006, it was a satire comic novel on the order of Absurdistan, set slightly in the future with some exaggerated elements. But as time went on, as America got darker and darker, so did the book.
Yeah, no, I remember thinking of some crazy things like the collapse of GM and Ford and Chrysler, and then taking a drive in a Chevy thinking, this car is not really good, is it? You know, it's no Hyundai Sonata, I'll say that. So I envisioned all these things, and things got, you know, actually reached that crisis point in this country. So I had to, as all satirists do, I have to exaggerate and exaggerate further until the whole country's bought by a Norwegian hedge fund. It's tough to be a satirist these days because we're moving at light speed towards some yet undefined future. You know, if I was a blogger, I could sort of change things every day. But, you know, it takes 3 years to write a decent novel, and by the time those 3 years elapse, God knows where you're at. God knows where the country's at, you know.
In terms of the future that you were talking about, you know, I kept thinking, of course, about Oryx and Crake and Year of the Flood, how Atwood tried to predict a future. And, of course, it's different from yours, but there are certain key similarities in terms of the way large corporations and the wealthy have taken over America and left the dregs behind.
Right. No, it's true. I mean, in this novel, there is no middle class. There are either high net worth individuals or low net worth individuals. There's very little in between. Atwood actually, I think, has a much closer connection to science. She explores scientific concepts with greater resonance than I think than I do. And she's, you know, she's quite interested, for example, in global warming. I can feel the effects of global warming living in New York City and reaching 110 degrees recently, but I can't quite write about it with the same kind of scientific finesse as she can.
Well, you do try to write about the scientific basis of the idea of living longer and immortality. Yes. So you did research on
I
that.
I did research that. No, I mean, I'm one of those writers who's quite obsessed with mortality, and I grew up in the Soviet Union. I was born in Leningrad, and the medicine there was not so hot, and I kept almost dying of asthma, which would be easily curable in America. My earliest memories, you know, the ambulances coming to take me away. So when you grow up like that, you think of mortality quite a bit. You know, I've had a lot of friends who are reaching their 40s and 50s and saying, you know, oh, my God, I can see that this life of mine is finite. I never had that. You know, I grew up from day one thinking I'm going to die soon. So,
well, also, you grew up in a country that was itself going through its own death throes, too.
Going through its own death throes, a country where men live till age 57 on average. Not a happy place.
I'm looking at America today and your projection of the America of a future, and I keep seeing the Soviet Union and what happened to the Soviet Union. How conscious was that parallel?
Well, it was quite conscious. You know, I grew up in a country rapidly disintegrating, and everyone in the back of their mind knew that this couldn't last the way things were. But also there was this kind of state-sponsored bursts of patriotism, because whenever the regime feels that things aren't going well, there's patriotism, there's a kind of xenophobia, and I think that's what's happening in America today. President Obama's election notwithstanding, the flags are getting bigger, the flagpoles are getting bigger, people are becoming more and more suspicious of immigrants, Mexicans. These are not good signs. These are signs of an empire, I think, in rapid decline. America's rise was so spectacular. I only hope that it can level out in a nice way, you know, like the Netherlands became became a nice pot-smoking country instead of the disaster.
Well, somewhere along the line, it was also taken over by Spain, so, you know.
Well, and that's, you know, and in this book, we're bought out by a Norwegian hedge fund, and the Chinese take a little slice of us, too, so one can only hope for the best.
Well, one problem, I think, in writing satire is that you've got to exaggerate, but, for instance, I read today that the Republican governor for Colorado thinks that bike sharing is a UN plot. I mean, what do you do when you're reading Tea Party stuff?
Yeah, in this book, there is only one party left. It's the bipartisan party.
Which seems to me to have grown out of what we've seen of Obama.
No, I think it's more of a right-wing party. There's a president who's maybe Obama-esque, but he's really just the puppet. It's Defense Secretary Rubenstein who runs the show, and he's my first Jewish strongman. I'm very proud to have a Jewish dictator in charge of my book. No, I do think of this as a kind of right-wing dictatorship with some sops to the liberal population. But there's only two networks left. There's Fox Liberty Prime and Fox Liberty Ultra. So I think the writing is on the wall. The National Guard is out in force. There's insurrections. There's a war in Venezuela, which is, of course, not going very well. Will this happen? I don't discount any of this happening.
I think that if you have enough knowledge of the history of dystopias, the realization is that projections are not reality, but what they are is the present looking at potential futures.
Right. Now, when you're writing a dystopia, you're really writing about the present moment. 1984 was about Stalinist Russia. It wasn't about a future London or whatever was described in the book.
When I mentioned Obama before, what I've noticed, particularly in certain areas like torture or privacy issues, it seems to me that rather than being a Democrat, we're seeing someone who's trying to play the bipartisan role, and that bipartisan role is, in effect, right-wing.
Right. No, I agree with that. I mean, I think, to me, bipartisanship is a kind of dirty word, because when you look at this country, you know, there's an insanely right-wing party, and then there's a moderately right-wing party, and those are the two choices. And if you're talking about bipartisanship, you're talking about somewhere in the middle of that right-wing insanity, which would not play in almost any other developed democracy in the world.
Gary Steingart, let's look at some of the elements of the book and how you got to that projection. You have something called apparats. Now, these are, I don't know, what's the pronunciation?
Well, technically, with all the umlauts, it'd be like apparat, but let's just call it an apparat.
Okay.
For the sake of our tongues and mouths.
The idea is that these are replacing the iPhones and the iPads.
Yeah, I think the future, as I see it in this book, is one of constant digitization. There's almost nothing analog left about the younger generation. There's two people. There's Lenny, who represents the older book-reading generation. He's 15 years older than the woman he loves, who is Eunice Park, a Korean immigrant, who is completely digitized. And the Apparat is a device that has this thing called Rate Me Plus technology. So everywhere you go, you're immediately rated by everyone in the room. So you walk into a bar, you know immediately you're the 18th ugliest person in the bar, or the 4th richest, or the 9th dumbest, or whatever it is. Well, we're constantly being rated. I mean, there's not, you know, there's credit ratings, which determine really the course of your life these days in America. If you're a writer, there's an Amazon ranking. I mean, God knows we're being ranked left and right. It's a strange feeling. There's if you're a professor, there's ratemyprofessor.com, where students rate you online and, you know, describe your hygiene and other things.
Have you actually found that and looked on your own?
I think I'm blessed that my students, you know, don't care enough about me to actually put me up there, but I don't know, maybe it exists or not. I'm a little scared to see it, you know, how my nose hair rates according to some nice 19-year-old student. That's sort of what I think is happening, is that we're constantly being judged. You know, it's a society. And if you go on, you know, on the Internet, and to research this book, I really had to indulge and get an iPhone and really start to look at these things. 80% of it, as far as I know, is just anger. You know, it's a very angry medium, and people are really unhappy, and they're jealous of success. The level of racism is something that when you live in, you know, maybe Berkeley or New York, you try to, you think is not as part of the societal rage, but oh my God, is it ever there?
And where have you been looking beyond, say, Facebook or Times.com?
I've just been surfing the whole thing left and right, including Russian sites, just the way people look at Putin, for example. I mean, that sometimes gives me hope. There's a huge reservoir of anger there against the regime that is allowed to sort of percolate on the Internet. The government controls the main television channels, which is how the majority of the population gets their information. So this is not a Luddite's reactionary attack on technology. I think the cow is out of the barn. There's no way we're going to go back here. I just think sometimes that we're not developed yet to deal with the kind of technology we're unleashing upon ourselves, that this takes more time, and that right now we're really throwing everything away that means things to us, like literature, while focusing solely on the forward march of technology.
I had something happen to me last week. For some reason, my modem didn't work.
Oh, no.
And it occurred to me until I got it working, which took a couple of phone calls. But there was a point one morning where it's occurred to me that, oh, my God, I won't have any Internet access, maybe for the day and the weekend, and I felt free.
You felt free, right?
Yeah.
Yeah, yeah, no. My latest addiction has been the iPhone, and it's destroyed my life so completely. You know, so much of my books are about New York City, and I used to walk around New York and just be completely involved in everything I saw around me. And now I've just become completely immersed. I'm walking around and looking at this screen. You know, I was walking by, and this gentleman was defecating on the street. I barely noticed him. I was looking at a YouTube video of a guy defecating on the street. When I go upstate, thankfully, upstate New York, iPhone is run by an American telephone and telegraph company, and they can't connect a call to save their lives. So when I go up there, nothing works, and I am free. For days on end, I am free to read books and walk around the forest and think and write.
Let's talk about the origins of Super Sad True Love Story. After finishing Absurdistan, what prompted you to develop a story that would be a satire about this future America?
Well, in Absurdistan, in my first book, The Russian Debutante Handbook, I sort of, you know, ran roughshod through the remains of the former Soviet Union. And I'd done my duty there. You know, my books, when they come out in Russia, get reviews like, you know, Balding Traitor Betrays Motherland, or Steingart Pleases His American Masters, you know. So I felt like I've done my duty in, as far as Russia's concerned. And then I started thinking of my adopted homeland and what was happening there, and like, seeing some of the parallels between the Soviet Union and this. And I also wanted to write a love story in a very serious way because, you know, Absurdistan featured a 325-pound man with a bad circumcision who kind of ran around sleeping with a bunch of hookers. And, you know, that's interesting enough. But in Super Sad True Love Story, I did want to write about two people and what it means in this digitized age to try to fall in love. You know, what does it mean to try to communicate when all these electronic barriers are in front of you? There was a freshman orientation, I think it was at NYU, where they had a seminar on how to talk without using Facebook, because some of these kids had no idea, and they just put them up on stage and said, all right, Billy, ask Johnny, you know, where he's from. Where are you from, Johnny? I'm from Sayasa. Me too, I'm from Long Island. You know, and they were so amazed that they could talk without the presence of Facebook or Twitter. And the book is called Verbaling, and it's done very rarely. And Verbaling is one of those things that actually happened to me when I was trying to order a dinner, and the waitress said, oh, did I verbal that to you, the cod special? And I thought, oh, I love you. That's great.
It sounds as if you're immediately taking on a bit of a problem in that you've got this, at least for the first part of the novel, a funny satire, but then you're doing a very serious human story within the context of this almost farcical world.
I think I tried something like that in Absurdistan as well, maybe to a lesser extent because it was more farcical all around, but the ending of it is not a happy ending, obviously. No, you know, I grew up a Soviet Jewish humor, a lot of Brezhnev jokes. The idea, I think, of all of it is, you know, let me make you laugh, come with me, I'll make you laugh, and then I'll show you the reality of the situation. I think all Jewish humor, in a sense, stems from the kind of humor at the edge of the grave, this tragedy that's about to consume us all, and then, you know, what are we going to do with it? Are we going to simply sing a terrible melody about it, or are we going to have some fun as we tap dance our way to the oblivion?
And that's why, I guess, when you name your favorite authors, they're people like Joseph Heller, Saul Bellow,
oh my goodness,
Philip Roth, Mordecai Richler.
I teach a course on them at Columbia called The Hysterical Male. It's all lovely because so many of my students are women trying to, I guess, understand how to write a hysterical male or understand the hysterical males in their lives.
Okay, so now you've got this idea. You're going to have a love story, and you're going to set it in this projected America. The main character, Lenny, of course, derives from Gary Steingart in some respects.
In some respect. I grew up projecting myself to be this rather enormous nebbish who would be sort of have stunted development and stumble around the world looking for love, never finding it. But I guess, you know, I sort of forced myself to avoid Lenny's fate in this book. But there are many similarities. Lenny has a bald spot shaped like the great state of Ohio. Mine is more sort of like West Virginia, but, you know, there are many similarities. The one difference, I think, between me and Lenny is that I was born in the Soviet Union. Lenny is a next generation, but he was born in America to Russian parents. So he doesn't really speak Russian. He doesn't really understand or care about Russia very much. He's obsessed with America and its decline. And for me, that's maybe a baby step away from the kind of immigrant characters that I've had before. Lenny and Eunice love each other partially because they're both from dysfunctional immigrant families, but they have so little in common otherwise. Eunice spends most of her time shopping online, of course, and Lenny tries to read War and Peace over and over again.
Why did you make the choice to have Eunice being Korean?
I grew up in, I went to Stuyvesant High School, as did you, and I think you went in during the pre-Asian days, but by the time I got there, it was mostly an Asian population with a couple of Russian Jews thrown in for fun to keep things interesting. And I was always in love with Korean culture and how much it reminded me of Soviet Jews. You know, both countries have some of the most horrifying histories you can imagine. You know, Korea living through the Japanese occupation and then, of course, the Korean War and Soviet Jews living through Hitler and Stalin and all those other nice guys. And also this feeling of being a small nation surrounded by larger ones, you know, Korea surrounded by China and Japan, Soviet Jews basically surrounded by Russia and other countries. And also our insane parents driving us crazy with the desire to succeed. There is a scene in the book where I think Lenny talks about getting slapped across the mouth for anything less than Cornell. And that was, you know, Cornell was the safety school at Stuyvesant. And I remember my parents being so incredibly, stoic about the fact that I would only go to Oberlin.
What makes you decide to create the split voices, which is on the one hand we have the voice of Lenny, in diaries, but it's more or less straight first-person novel.
Yeah, more like a Belovian kind of voice.
Then the other side, we've got not merely Eunice, but her friends and paramours writing these long emails.
You know, I find the voice of the next generation fascinating. I'm not one of those people that says, oh, my God, they're terrible just because they don't speak the same way I do. You know, there's going to be progress in language. Things are going to move ahead. But it is interesting, you know, Eunice is one of the more intelligent people of her generation. Lenny describes her as my reluctant sentence monger because she actually speaks in full sentences with a subject and a predicate, and that's very unusual in this society. But she does use acronyms, some of which I can't say on the radio. One is Timatov, which sounds like a Hebrew word, Timatov, which means think I'm about to openly vomit, which is what she says whenever she sees Lenny naked or things like that. I just wanted to have a nice contrast between these two, the analog and the digital generations, how they speak. And it's also, I think, you know, just as a narrative strategy, it's always good to vary things. I don't think this novel would have been as easy to read with 330 pages of just Lenny whining about his bald spot and his place in the society.
And I don't think it would have been particularly easy to read if you hadn't given her subjects and predicates either.
I know. You know, that was a sort of concession to the literary form, because most of the people in Eunice's generation in this future do not speak as eloquently as she does. So I had to obviously create a more literate background for her.
You did manage to put in illiterate signs all over New York City.
Yes, so the future, the restoration, there's an agency called the American Restoration Authority, basically trying very hard to rebuild the collapsing infrastructure. The Williamsburg Bridge goes out and stuff like that, but they don't have very good spelling. I think repair is spelled R-E-P-A-R-E. Let's repair this bridge.
You place Lenny inside the post-human services with a boss who wants to stay young forever, reminding me a lot of the Catherine Helmond character in Terry Gilliam's Brazil.
Yes. Yes, Lenny works for a company called Posthuman Services, and they're just trying to find a cure for death. And they market their services to high net worth individuals, people with 20 million or more investable assets. And, you know, they're doing a brisk business, because a lot of people in reality are into this kind of stuff, cryogenics and all kinds of life extension. And they're mostly men, which is very interesting. I found this out in research, is that women, maybe because they're able to reproduce, are less obsessed with living forever, with immortality. But Lenny is quite obsessed, because he's 39 years old. And in this society, being 39 is akin to being more than dead, whereas his boss Joshi is in his 70s but looks like Lenny's younger brother, because he has all these dechronification treatments done to him, all this cellular repair, new blood. He has a new blood called smart blood that courses through his veins very quickly. Especially after Lenny meets Eunice and falls in love with her, he desperately wants to live forever and maybe even steal some of Eunice's youth.
Why did you choose to put Lenny in that particular situation?
Well, not to bemoan my own past, but I did not have a childhood that I enjoyed very much. And I would love to, as many people, I would just love to repeat it, you know. And boy, if I could be young again and go back and redo all those things, maybe with slightly more drugs or slightly less, you know, slightly more hair and slightly more drugs, I think it would be a wonderful wonderful life.
Why put him in post-human services? Why did you decide that that would be the crux, the central element within the novel?
Well, as societies fall apart, the need to survive becomes more and more important. And this is the ultimate kind of survival, the idea that you will never die, even as the country dies around you. This is a very developing world phenomenon that I see a lot, because I do travel to countries like Thailand or Brazil. You know, the elite lives like no other elite on the planet lives, and the poor, of course, suffer like no other poor suffer in the favelas, etc. And I think this whole quest for immortality, there's a political dimension to it, too. New York in the book becomes what's called a lifestyle hub, which it already is becoming, so that poor people are just asked to please leave and go to upstate New York or go to, you know, West Virginia or wherever. Just get out of our sight unless you're, you know, fixing our toilets. There's a small cadre for that. But in this book, living forever is a political statement, because it means that other people's lives will be impacted by your immortality, and not in a good way.
Why in the middle of the book did you decide to just kind of blow everything up?
I think in every novel I write, there's a lit fuse stemming through the first 200 pages, and by page 201 or so, you know, there's a natural explosion. Russia, the Soviet Union, it imploded. People think of it as a kind of almost velvet revolution. Things just fell apart. But I remember one of the first times coming back to Russia in the 90s during the Yeltsin era, taking a bus ride. There was a hole in the middle. It was one of those bendy buses, you know, with two halves. And the rubber in between these two halves had a hole that was the size of a child, and there was a child that was almost falling out of it. And I thought, wow, this country is finished. The Soviet Union that I grew up in, I mean, it wasn't a perfect society by any means, but it was a lower middle class country, and it was all gone. I was in Sierra Leone. And I thought, this is so easy for things like this to happen. You know, Argentina, up to the 60s even, was a country with double the income of Italy. Now it's a country that's basically Romania with better stakes. So how does this happen so quickly? Well, it does. There's a lot of entropy when it comes to nations. The problem is countries like Russia, countries like America, with our messianic ideas of who we are, that we're not just another country, we are the country, you know. It's very hard for us to take in the fact that our greatness may have passed. And I wonder what will happen, and this is part of this novel, is how will Americans deal with the fact that our greatness may be eclipsed by other rising powers like China, for example. We're still the world's largest economy by far, and we still have a great cultural impact on the world through our horrifying movies and ridiculous television shows and really spoiled celebrities. So there's still a ginormous effect that we have on the world. And some of that will wane in different phases. The United Kingdom is no longer an empire to contend with, but it still has a very large cultural footprint. And a lot of this also has to do with English. You know, will Mandarin supplant English as a world language? If it doesn't, then America will still have some kind of cultural impact in it.
It still amazes me when I see photos of the new cities of China and then compare them to the crumbling cities of America.
That is actually a scene in the book where Lenny talks about going to China and landing at an airport that he describes as being as complex and beautiful as a coral reef. The airport thing is something amazing. You know, you fly out of Newark Airport. I can't understand how that still functions as an airport. And then you land in some place like Shenzhen, which was just a little fishing village 20 years ago and now has buildings taller than the Empire State and a new subway system. And you realize that in this century, the Chinese will, unless something terrible happens, will do what we did in the turn of the last century.
Let's talk a little bit about your career. As you said, you grew up in Russia, came to the United States. I understand you didn't speak English without an accent until you passed into your teens.
My parents spoke only Russian in the house. We had no television set. It was awful television shows outside the door, the A-Team. Then we came in to the house. There was just, you know, Chekhov's Lady with Lapdog. So because of that, I was able to maintain Russian completely. But on the other hand, my accent was terrible. So I was about 13, 14 when I finally lost, and I would practice in front of the mirror. I had trouble with words like attic. I always say addict. Go up to the addict, you know. So I had to work so hard in the mirror to get that right. I didn't have very many friends, and things weren't so great. But in the end, I'm happy that I maintained Russian. I couldn't have written a novel like Absurdistan. I couldn't have written without going back to Russia, to the former Soviet republics, and being able to understand all the horrifying things that were being said around me.
Well, you went to Stuyvesant, and then you went to Oberlin. You got a degree in politics. So was writing at that point in the back of your mind at all?
No, not at all. I mean, I have a minor in creative writing, and the first book, A Russian Debutante's Handbook, was mostly written at Oberlin. So, but politics, you know, my parents wanted me to go to law school, and but I actually had a great teacher there and some great political science teachers. It was comparative politics, and I think in the end, all that stuff really helped because it gave me a nice, you know, quasi-Marxist idea of how the world ticks.
Then you came back to New York and worked for a refugee resettlement agency.
Oh, God, I would work in so many different places and get summarily fired from so many of them or laid off. My goal was to work in a bunch of places which would be non-profit, because when there's no profit, you can lock the door and work on your own novel, and nobody really is the wiser until a year elapses and they realize you haven't done anything, and then they tell you to go to the next nonprofit. But it was wonderful. And the first nonprofit I worked for, the resettlement agency called the New York Association for New Americans, was the basis for the resettlement agency in the Russian Debutante's Handbook. I often think of myself as functioning as a quasi-journalist who takes good notes about everything that goes on around him and transforms those into these novels that are sort of novels of the moment, I would hope.
A book like Absurdistan, you say you went back and did your research in the former Soviet Union.
Yeah, it was really funny. You know, I would hang out in Georgia and Azerbaijan, all these countries, and I would meet these crazy people. One guy in Azerbaijan always tried to kidnap me. He kept saying, you know, can we please kidnap you, and then we can get a ransom out of Random House, your publisher, and, you know, we can get millions. And I said, based on my last book sales, we'll probably get, you know, $1,000 out of them. And he said, well, it would cost more to feed you, you know, so let's not do that.
And you also went to Prague. You lived in Prague for a while?
I was a student in Prague my junior year abroad. That also helped form the basis of my first book, The Russian Debutante's Handbook. For me, what was really striking was here I was going back to sort of my roots, the Eastern Bloc, and it was post the Velvet Revolution, and it was surrounded by Americans trying to be hip writers and musicians, but mostly they were there to get, you know, to have sex and drink these 15-cent beers that were very, very tasty in Prague and eat the... They were all vegetarian, and the whole diet was pork-based. That alone was worth the price of admission, watching a furry gentleman trying to eat their way past the pork cutlets. Everywhere I go, I seem to have good luck in stumbling onto whatever is pertinent at the moment.
And now that you've written Super Sad True Love Story, and it was finished, let's say, a year ago, how does the projection tie in? You think you're still right on the money?
Well, I think the basics of it are fundamentally sound. You know, I'm not some great prognosticator. I'm not, you know, Steingart the Wise here. It's about a nation trending downwards, but I think so much of our great art recently has been about the same topic, whether or not it takes the kind of satiric, futuristic approach that this book does. I mean, if you watch a show like The Sopranos or The Wire, you know, what are you really watching? You're really watching a nation in decline as seen through the eyes of these brilliant writers and directors and actors, you know. And this maybe takes a slightly more funnier note or in some ways a more pessimistic note because it's set somewhat in the future. But in a way, I don't think any of this book is a particularly huge departure from a lot of the kind of art we've seen. You know, writers, artists of any kind respond to the world around them. When America was on the ascent, the fiction of the time mirrored that, often very critically, but it certainly mirrored that. This is our swan song, and it's obviously going to have a different melody.
Do you think that's also the reason why right now there are all these zombie and, and movies and horror movies of a particular type, they're not horror movies of scare because a lot of these movies are comedies like Zombieland, but they're movies about people becoming these just flesh-eating creatures, whether they be vampires or zombies.
Well, the zombie intrigues me a lot because I feel like a zombie sometimes, you know. I get up, flurry of emails that in the end signify nothing. I have to answer all of them. The iPhone is pinging, saying, oh, look at me, here's some information that you desperately have to get into your mind. Don't read books, they're stupid. They're not going to fuel your day the way I'm going to fuel your day, you know. And I walk out of my apartment in New York and the thing is pinging more. I'm ignoring all the reality around me. Am I becoming zombified? You know, maybe. Maybe the zombie movie makes such sense because I feel such a kinship to these brainless creatures.
Anna Quinlan, when I was talking to her about the 24/7 news cycle, said the funny thing is if you seriously watch these 24/7 news stations, you realize there's no news.
There's no news. We've gone to a completely news-free format. It's astounding. When I was writing this book, I felt bad. I usually put my characters through hell. You know, poor Misha in Absurdistan gets circumcised at age 18 in the cruelest way possible. But I've started falling in love with these guys a little bit, Lenny and Eunice, and I thought, oh my God, what am I doing to them? And then I thought, it's not me, it's the society, it's this world. You know? I'm just the author here. I'm just typing in what needs to be typed in. I am more pessimistic than I've ever been, and I think the first book, The Russian Debutante's Handbook, actually has a kind of optimistic flavor to it. You know, I started writing it in 1994, we're still in the middle of the Clinton era. Things weren't perfect, but, you know, there was hope for Russia. There was hope for America. There was a feeling of who knows what's going to happen. But there weren't 105, 110 degree temperatures in upstate New York that are boiling my dachshund alive.
As the book progressed, did you find the characters at any time moving in directions that you were not planning? I mean, I could see that happening, that you know from the beginning that this relationship isn't going to last, but were there any points where you're kind of going, maybe I need to change that?
Yeah, no, several points. I thought, you know, this is not how, especially with the ending, I thought, you know, this is not how I want this thing to end. I want to have more glimpses of hope. In the end, there are maybe a few tiny ones, but not really.
Not really, no.
In the end, we all die, you know, and that's, to me, that's not necessarily an unhappy ending, because the alternative of eternal life is something, when you ponder it for too long, there are quite serious problems with that too. But here there's death without a kind of redemption. You know, nothing good comes out of anything. China on the ascent does not become a happy, benevolent power either. You know, not that America ever was, but I don't quite foresee China playing that role either. So in the end, what we have is an ebb to civilization. And one of the saddest things for me is the fact that literacy is completely extinguished in this book. The long-form reading of text is completely gone. Nobody knows how to do it. Eunice, who goes to a college, a liberal arts college, majors in images and has a minor in assertiveness. They read texts in those colleges, but they only scan them for information. You're not supposed to actually read the words one by one. To me, and maybe I'm speaking from a very privileged and from a very personal position as a writer, but to me, that there's something very sad about the fact that if literature does not exist, we will never be able to fully enter the mind of another human being the way we do when we pick up a book and say, oh my God, Evelyn Waugh was a jerk, but boy, am I interested in the way his mind works.
Gary Steingart, has there been any interest from Hollywood on Absurdistan or Super Sad True Love Story?
I think Super Sad is the one that that producers say, oh my goodness, there's a Steingart's written a about an attractive girl, you know, who's young and uncircumcised. This could be our ticket in, you know. Whereas Absurdistan, oh my God, you know, what are you going to do with that? I will pay someone money to make that one.
So you haven't gotten anything specific on any of these?
No, the first book was optioned for a while, and this book is, I think, about to become optioned. So, but we'll see. You know, the problem I think with all these books is they're costly to make. They're pretty high concept. There's a lot of Right. And Alice Munro's story, you know, brought to life. There's a lot of pyrotechnics.
Do you see yourself moving into other realms like theater or screenplay?
I wouldn't mind. You know, as I said when I was talking about The Sopranos and The Wire, I find those stories amazing. I mean, I just have to think of something that would be worthy of actually investing my time and other people's time into. The next book, I think, will be a collection of essays, which I'm sure will be sold as a memoir. But, you know, I do want to take a little break from this kind of fiction. It wears out your gears a little bit. It's a lot of projecting and researching, whereas I would love to just go back and think about the way my own life is shaped up. I think it's been fairly interesting enough, I think, for a book. And I've written so many essays for The New Yorker and Three Penny Review and all these other wonderful things. So it's time to make something out of that.
You've been listening to an interview with Gary Steingart, whose latest novel is Super Sad True Love Story. I'm Richard Walensky on Cover to Cover.